Garden State Debate, where the talk is real. Garden State Debate, no joke, no frills. Garden State Debate, it's the talk of the town. Garden State Debate, for people all around, yeah. Garden State Debate, Garden State Debate, Garden State Debate.
In this episode of Garden State Debate, Dr. Jack Audette, the Chief Medical Officer of Overlook Medical Center in New Jersey, joins us to give a true inside look of the coronavirus pandemic, what they learned, how they rose to the occasion, and what he expects in the fall of 2020. For more podcast and videocast information, you can visit our website at www.gardenstatedebate.com. Or you can contact us at podcast@gardenstatedebate.com. You can hit us up on Twitter at GSDebatePodcast or myself, Ryan, the host, at RyeHost. And as always, the wonderful music, instrumentals, and lyrics provided by Jairus Cook. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the podcast, Garden State Debate. My name's Ryan. I'll be your host today. And with me, I have Dr. Jack Audette. Dr. Jack Audette is the Chief Medical Officer at Overlook Medical Center, part of the Atlantic Health System. And he is a board certified in internal medicine and has been a clinical and administrative leader in hospitals in Virginia and Rhode Island prior to coming to Overlook. Overlook, home to one of the state's largest and highly regarded neuroscience programs, has been nationally recognized as one of America's 50 best hospitals by HealthGrades and regionally recognized by US News and the World Report, as well as landing in Newsweek's list of world's best hospitals 2 consecutive years. When the COVID-19 pandemic arose in our communities here in New Jersey, Dr. Audette was at the forefront as the hospital transformed to handle this unprecedented threat to our communities. He joins us today to share how Overlook rose to the occasion, share his experiences, what they've learned at Overlook Medical Center, and what he expects to come as New Jersey enters into the fall. So with that, I'd like to welcome you, Dr. Jack Audette. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. If I could call you Ryan, then please call me Jack.
Okay.
Okay.
Will do.
All right.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Jack. So I want to jump into it. Obviously, we're going to talk about the coronavirus pandemic today. We want to talk about kind of the overarching resource planning, how it quickly hit us back in March and where we're at now and what we can plan for in the future. But before we jump into it, I just wanted to ask if you had anything else you'd like to add about your background, your involvement at Overlook Medical Center, and kind of how you fit into Overlook Medical Center in terms of management and the practice.
Sure. So I've been at Overlook now for 6.5 years. Basically, my role is to help coordinate activities of the medical staff. And my primary focus in regards to the delivery of care is taking a look at patient safety and quality, those types of things. So that's my job in a nutshell.
Okay, so obviously this is a great topic then for you. You've probably had some very close and very eye-opening interactions during the pandemic. So just to jump into kind of, let's walk back to the early March, or even if it's earlier for you guys, if you can kind of provide a little bit of insight as to the first cases of coronavirus came to New Jersey. Obviously, we heard about them in New York and up in Westchester, and then also up in the Teaneck area of New Jersey. But can you give us a little insight as to when did Overlook become aware and concerned of the pandemic, and when did kind of the preparation, or it was probably more of a sudden need to to put all hands on deck. But when did that start? Can you give us a kind of an insight as to the timing of that?
Sure. Yeah, I think that the conversations about this really started in early February in terms of the planning, because there was an awareness that it was going to arrive at some point. No one was really certain what the extent of the disease was that we were going to experience here. So that's when planning really started. Our first case actually materialized on March 7th. And within the week, we now had four cases. But then going from the middle of March to early April, to the point that we had 80 patients on ventilators with COVID and another couple hundred of COVID patients in the house. So it just really expanded exponentially.
Yeah, so sorry, at what point did it go from, I caught you on the initial four, it went to 200 in the ICU by what time? By
the around what day? This was over a couple weeks. Yeah, so our peak was in early April. And when we got to that point, we had a little over 80 patients with COVID in the intensive care units, and then another 13 patients in intensive care with other issues, and then close to a couple of hundred COVID patients up on the medical surgical floors when we really were at our max.
Okay, yeah. So then getting into that, getting into kind of the peak in the early to mid-April range, which I believe was the peak for all of New Jersey, is we've been terribly hit during that time period. Overlook as a whole, were you guys devoted, were you increasing capacity in the hospital to accommodate COVID patients? Was there such an influx of patients that you had to expand or almost resurrect different areas to handle the situation?
I think probably the best way to start that answer is to look at critical care beds. So we are licensed for 40 beds, and our average census is like 26 to 30, and that's what we will staff. And when the patients first started arriving, they were very, very sick. And so, I'm thinking back to our hospital president, Alan Lieber, his question would always be, well, where are we going to put the next five patients? Mm-hmm. And now I look at that and think five patients really makes me sort of chuckle now, because it grew just that quickly. So the question is, how do you take a hospital that has capacity for 40 critical care patients and get it to the point where we could accommodate 100 patients, which was our goal when we started doing our initial planning in February. And the way that we initially started doing that is our ICU rooms are private rooms. What we did is we actually doubled up, turned them into semi-private rooms. So two critical care patients in the room. And so if you take the 40 beds and do the multiplication, that gets us a good chunk of where we need to be. In addition to that, we took some intermediate care units that are sort of in between regular medical, surgical, and critical care, and converted those into critical care beds. And then lastly, we had to go to the medical surgical floors. And, again, the scenario there was those rooms are actually semi-private to begin with, the majority of them. And so we had to make certain that if we patients together, we need to make certain that if we had a patient with COVID, that you had another patient with COVID, not with something else, because you don't want the COVID patients getting some other virus, and you don't want another patient with some other type of virus getting COVID. So that enters into the discussion of testing, which I think everyone has heard a lot about that through the media. Testing has been a challenge. And here in the Atlantic Health System, we had access to a rapid test called Cepheid that you can run in about 30 minutes. The problem is the number of tests that we actually had at our beck and call. And so the way that I use those initially, and we had 25 or so that we could use per day. The population that I used those in were patients that we had a high probability they were going to have COVID. We would test them to confirm that they did, and then we would cohort them with another patient who we knew had the virus. And we needed to do the cohorting or we were frankly going to run out of beds, and we needed to remain open to service our community. So that was the testing strategy. It actually served.
And you call it a rapid test, and that's interesting because I think we hear a lot about right now, you have like the Rutgers rapid test and some others that are being rolled out here in New Jersey and across the nation. But what was the rapid test like back in April? I mean, was that like a one-day turnaround type of situation?
Yeah, and testing has evolved quite a bit. So when I'm talking about Cepheid, our rapid test, it's actually a rapid PCR test, which has high sensitivity and specificity. So that was the one we were using in-house. We also had tests that we were initially, actually a lot of these tests had to go out to the state, as many will recall. So and to the CDC. So at one point initially, these tests were going out with a turnaround of several days. Then we were able to get the Cepheid in-house. That was a big help. But along with that, we had another PCR test that we were doing in-house, actually in our central lab. And that had a longer turnaround time. And then there were tests that we were also sending out. So it was really sort of a hodgepodge of solutions given the hodgepodge of testing options that we had. And the one that really helped us the most was that rapid PCR test Cepheid, of which we had 25 per day. And I use those very cautiously. I can tell you that for a patient to get a Cepheid test at Overlook Medical Center, it needed to have my approval because there were only 25 of them per day. I'm losing the audio there, Ryan.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can. Yep.
So, no, that's a good point about the lack of the little bit of resources in terms of testing or PPE. I wanted to ask you about that. So I think you made a good point about you had a certain a primitive amount of tests that you could give. There was obviously a bigger amount of people that probably needed them. If you had more tests, you would have given them to everyone, but you had to obviously make certain choices.
I'm just going to interject. It's interesting because it was really fascinating to me from the perspective of the clinical acumen of our physicians in the emergency department, because I was trusting them to tell me who they really felt had it. I was looking for laboratory confirmation. And the first day that we did this, I can tell you that their clinical prediction was correct 100% of the time. They knew exactly what they were dealing with. And so the other thing that we were doing in the emergency department is we would see patients who clinically we felt they had COVID. They were not ill enough to come into the hospital. So the advice to them was that you need to go home, you need to quarantine, you need to behave as if you have COVID, although we lack the testing capacity to really prove that.
That's a good question too. Being that you had a limited number of beds, you basically doubled up the occupancy of beds available. And then you had other people also in the hospital with COVID. So was there a certain kind of criteria? Obviously, someone's in really terrible shape in terms of lung capacity and breathing and things like that. What were kind of the factors that you guys, Overlook Medical Center, looked at in terms of bringing someone into the hospital versus putting them in an ICU bed versus sending them home?
Okay. Well,
I think part of that we kind of can figure out just based on common sense, but was there a certain sort of like kind of like a hybrid type of checklist that was used, or if you have these X, Y, and Z symptoms, then you can go home, or was it an age thing? Did that factor into it?
Yeah, well, it was really a matter of the clinical acumen of the physician in the emergency department taking a look at the patient, and the question ultimately is, are they sick enough to be in the hospital or are they able to go home? So the different types of things work into that. And one of them would be looking at their vital signs, you know, where are those? What is the oxygen saturation that the patient has? And so many of the symptoms are really respiratory related. And then we would take a look at their age. Do they have any other underlying medical conditions that would make you suspicious that the patient is going to do better or poor? Age, those types of things. So, you know, if someone was frankly sick enough to be in the hospital, they came into the hospital. It was a conservative approach in terms of who we initially sent home, from the standpoint that so little was known about the virus. Initially, as we're seeing this, the threshold to admit people was fairly low because we weren't certain how they were going to go. As we got more experience with the virus and had a feel clinically for how patients were going to do, and beds became tighter, we actually developed a program through Atlantic Health where we were able to set patients up who looked like they were doing okay, but their oxygens were a little bit low. So what can we do to set them up at home with home oxygen, with virtual visits via iPads or whatever, so we could sort of check in on the patients, have their physicians follow up with them and follow them in that fashion. And we had to be cautious in regards to that population because we didn't want to send people home to fail and have to return. And I think we did a pretty good job of sorting those patients out in terms of people that we were able to send home were able to stay home and sort of weather the storm.
Interesting. And I want to get to in a couple minutes kind of where we're at now, and it might involve some of that at home tele-PT and things that people can do and stuff that we learned. But I still want to talk a little bit more about the peak and what was going on, because I think a lot of people, you know, we watch TV, we hear from the governor and the Department of Health, and we take our cues from the little bit of resources we have. But this is a very excellent opportunity to kind of hear what's going on the inside. So when Overlook Medical Center was at its peak with about 80 people in ICU.
And then the rest, yeah, total of probably about 260 to 270 when we were really at our peak total COVID patients.
What percentage of the hospital was actually devoted to COVID at that time? Like roughly, was it like half, more, all?
I wish it was half. No, it was.
I know from your comments about the ICU and turning other parts into rooms that it's obviously going to be significant.
It was probably close to 80%. The thing that happened when COVID really took root is that anything that was elective got canceled. We basically closed the operating rooms to any type of elective surgery. You needed to have the hot appendix or gallbladder to come in and get a surgery now, or have fallen and broken a hip, something like that. So the OR was open to those cases, but anything elective was just shut down. And patients really had a fear of coming to the hospital. So unfortunately, I think we probably had people stay home who had conditions that would have benefited from being in the hospital, be it small heart attack, a stroke, things like that. It really slowed down. I can tell you probably the best barometer of this is when I come in the morning, I see our daily report, I take a look at the number of behavioral health patients who are on hold in our emergency department who need to be admitted to an involuntary bed, because we don't provide that service here. And usually it's 5, 6, 7 patients we need to find a bed for them somewhere. Well, I can tell you that for a month or so, those patients disappeared. The answer was zero. We had no patients that were on hold waiting those beds. And clearly those issues don't go away. So there are a lot of people who were at home with their underlying conditions sort of weathering things.
Interesting. And as far as like PPE, protective equipment during the onset and up to the peak, and then we can talk about where we're at now in terms of going forward, but I'm sure that I would guess that there was a lack of, we already talked about tests. How about gowns and masks and stuff for, you know, whether it be staff or patients? Was there a lack of that? And how were you actively sourcing it from somewhere? How did that?
I think one of the advantages is that we belong to, I just lost you on my video here, so let me bring you back here.
Okay. I can still see you.
Yeah, I timed out there. There we are. So in terms of, I think there's a big advantage of being part of a large healthcare system because it allows you access to a lot of things that you might have greater difficulty obtaining. We kept ahead of the curve in terms of PPE throughout this. Now, that's not to say that it was not a challenge. And so with our N95 respirators, we put a plan into place where we would reprocess these for the individual with ultraviolet light, which kills the virus. And we would go through so many days of reprocessing before that N95 would have to be fully retired and we would replace it. So we were able to keep ahead of that. We did pretty well with gowns and gloves, not an issue there. I remember watching the news and seeing some of these hospitals in New York where poor nurses were dressed in garbage bags, for goodness sake. So, we never got to that type of a situation. So we really kept ahead of things. We followed the recommendations from the CDC, which creates some confusion because that continued to evolve as the CDC got smarter through this and got more experience with the virus. And then, and frankly, you really have to wonder sometimes if some of the recommendations may have been influenced in some fashion by the availability of PPE on a national level. But I think we did a pretty good job of it here at Overlook. The one commodity that caused some anxiety at one point is we got to late on a Friday, actually, you're running out of ventilators. And I thought this is going to be a problem this weekend. And we had a plan in place where we would be able to use anesthesia machines, which would be sort of a poor man's ventilator. And that's what we were ready to do. But fortunately, what came to be is connections to the system, we were able to have conversations with administrators at Johns Hopkins, the Carilion Clinic in Virginia, and some hospitals in Philadelphia that actually lent us some of the ventilators that they were not using. So we had a big shipment arrived on a Saturday. The cavalry arrived in the nick of time, and we did not have to use that plan with the using the anesthesia machines as ventilators. That was probably the closest we got to me feeling a little panic in terms of what are we going to do. Although we had a plan, it was not an ideal plan.
Of course. I think it's from being on the outside, not being in the hospital, I think a lot of people have a lot of empathy towards the folks that were fighting this during the peak. And I wanted to ask you if did you receive any community support in terms of community outreach, community donations, things like that? And was that part of the fabric of what was going on or?
Yeah, that answer would be twofold. We have a very active foundation here at Overlook, taking a look at philanthropy. And so they were really geared up. And interestingly, there was a real response in regards to PPE. People, for whatever reason, had their own stockpile of a different type of respirators and masks, et cetera, that they wanted to come and provide to us. So we were able to utilize those. And then the other piece is nutrition. And so there was a steady caravan of cars arriving here with pizzas and what have you. And at one point I was laughing that the COVID-19 is actually for the 19 pounds we're going to gain through this pandemic. So the community, you really felt the love and support. So actually, I'll thank all the listeners for what you did.
Yeah, and I think everyone would thank you, you and the Overlook Medical Center and all of the hospitals in New Jersey for stepping up and doing everything they can to keep everyone safe. I wanted to ask you, I think you kind of pretty much answered it already, but there was no point where the medical center had to go on like divert, because you're part of the Atlantic Health Network, so you have that sharing as it is. But it sounds like at every point in time you were planning ahead, whether it was PPE or staffing and things like that. But in terms of staffing, was there ever an issue with staffing? And if there was it ever great enough where the hospital had to like go on divert?
Okay, so a couple of answers. The answer is that actually we did have to go on divert for several very brief periods at the time when we were really at our fullest. And what dictated that was, frankly, our emergency department had been totally overwhelmed. And at that point, if there was another option for patients to go to, it was probably better, from the standpoint that we had a lot of patients in the corridors, in the emergency department. And frankly, if you came in, if you didn't have COVID, you could darn well end up with it. So, when we hit that point, that was the release valve. And we went on diversion for a short period of time till we could get the emergency department stabilized and the patients out of there and admitted to the floors. Interestingly, we ended up with a lot of patients from other zip codes that we don't usually service. And the reason for that is that I think the virus hit harder east of us, closer you got to New York City. And as our sister institutions in New Jersey were overwhelmed, a number of them actually did go on diversion, and frankly, for prolonged periods of time. So we had a lot of influx of patients that from areas that we usually do not serve that landed here for their care. And we really pride ourselves on keeping the door open for everyone who comes here for service. And we really did a very good job of that throughout most of the surge. And that's actually something that the hospital is very proud of, that we were able to keep the doors open.
So just to clarify, when we're talking about diversion, we're talking about patients? Or are we talking about staff?
Diversion would be we let the rescues know that if they're picking someone up, they need to take them to another hospital. And it was usually dictated by the emergency department. And Tom, in regards to our hospital staffing, we were able to meet the demand fairly well. The interesting thing is there was a lot of COVID in the community, and there was some COVID that hit our community as well. So we had a number of healthcare workers that contracted the virus and had to stay home and heal up before they could come back to work. So we had a fair number of sick folks. And then you have specialty individuals. And probably, again, the best example would be in critical care, where there's a national shortage of critical care physicians to begin with. And we were staffed. Our sweet spot, as I told you before, was 30 to 40 patients usually. And now we're up to 80. And then with non-COVID critical care, 90 we were up to at one point in time. So how do you do that? And then the same with nurses. That's a specialty, a specific skill set that those nurses have. And so the way that we manage that in the critical care areas is we took someone who was the expert and we gave them what we called euphemistically a buddy. And the buddy would be someone who is the same profession, but not the same skill set. And so what we look for them to do would be to do the tasks that would be within their purview, that would free up the critical care physician or nurse to do the things that were really specific to their skill set. So as an example, at one point in time, we had our section chief for critical care would be on duty, and she would have our section chief for cardiology was moonlighting as her buddy because his office was closed. So, and he smiled and said, "Here I am, I'm like a resident or a fellow again. I'm not the chair of the section, but I'm gonna do what I can during this pandemic." And that, I have to tell you, that really impressed me when people were willing to do what they had to do to step in. And we saw the similar types of things with nursing, where it would be one critical care nurse would have a buddy, and that would increase the ratio of patients they could provide care to.
That's great to hear that everyone's kind of stepping up. And I was actually going to ask you a question about that in terms of like morale. If you're in the room or on the floor of a COVID, of an ICU wing or whatever you would like to call it, I'm sure you can tell us, but people are probably pretty much locked in for an extended period of time without being able to be in contact with others in the hospital, and then they would go home and they'd come back and they'd do it again. So it must have been, I would assume it'd be a kind of a dramatizing experience, but also a rewarding one in terms of fighting for, humanity and people's lives. So did you ever get a sense of, or you probably have a sense of, what was the morale like from inside those rooms? Like from nurses to epidemiologists to ER, what was it like? What were people feeling?
Yeah, there was a lot of esprit de corps in terms of everyone sort of having each other's back, recognizing we're in this together. I had a colleague once taught me an interesting expression, and when faced with adversity, his comment to me is, well, this is the type of situation that really makes you determine who you would go rock climbing with. And what I would share with you is that through this experience, I can tell you there's a lot of people that I would be willing to go rock climbing with.
Good.
And so, I got a lot of really good colleagues, but I can't candy coat it. This took an emotional toll. The mortality rate was exceptionally high in hospitalized patients, particularly early on, before we really learned some of these tricks with prone ventilating, for remdesivir, for some of these other types of things. Mortality was extremely high. And that takes its toll. I mean, we are not a top 50 hospital for not being able to perform. So we look at mortality and we do a great job here. So that was really tough for people to swallow. And you go up to the ICU and you take a look, and each room had two patients on it on ventilators. They're medically induced comas. And it just tugs at you. And I think we're still looking at the aftermath of this. And I wonder which of my colleagues will have some elements of PTSD from this. We've sent a survey out to the providers and workers here just to sort of assess where they are. And although they will tell you that they felt a great sense of purpose, that I have colleagues that really took a look and questioned, is this a field that I want to continue? Is suicide an option? Is suicide easier than what I'm dealing with at the moment? People had those thoughts. Unfortunately, did not experience that here. But, I know that colleagues had those types of thoughts. This was a very trying time.
Yeah, no, that's sadly, but true. And I think a lot of people on the outside that are not even, luckily contracting COVID are experiencing a lot of those types of depression and things that you mentioned as well. So that kind of brings us up to like where we're at now, and you kind of just made the transition yourself, and
we're in a better place.
A better place. Take a breather. Hopefully it'll be permanent.
I'll make my predictions if pressed, but we're in a pretty good place right now. And, I got to tell you, the science is right that masks, social distancing, hand hygiene, those are the best tools that we have. And New Jersey has really done a great job. And I know it's been tough on people to follow all these rules, but we're doing a really good job. We take a look at asymptomatic patients that we test. Let's say you're going to come in for an elective surgical procedure, we want to test you for COVID, because if you're an asymptomatic carrier, we don't want to expose the anesthesiologist, the surgeon, the scrub tech, the nurse in the OR. to your illness. So we're screening all those patients. And initially, we were seeing some positives with the asymptomatics. For a number of weeks, 5 or 6 weeks, we're not seeing that now because the positivity in the community is way, way down.
Great.
And so that's, yeah, so that's very positive. In terms of the number of COVID positive patients in the house, we haven't had more than 5 for a number of weeks. And we've been hovering around, you know, 3 to 4, but again, no more than 5, with a couple of person, what we call PUIs, person under investigation. People have come in and we're waiting for a test to sort of sort out where they are. So we do not have a dedicated COVID intensive care unit at this point. We do have one floor where if someone has a medical surgical floor where a patient would go if they had this, because we've got things all set up to isolate those patients. So we're in a much better place in that regard. The trick though is that the concern is, are we going to have a recurrence, another surge over the winter? So we've been spending a lot of time putting together what I would call a pandemic playbook, and we've worked through the entire system by discipline, critical care, et cetera. So we would meet at phase one right now, which is that there is COVID in the community, it's in the hospital, but it's not to the point that we need to be corruption and things there. But yeah, the COVID in the community is way, way down from where it was. So I feel we're pretty good about that. And as I'm taking a look at the potential for another round of this, another surge, I'm an optimist. I don't think we're going to see anything like we saw back in April due to the public health measures that we've implemented at this point in time. I think we're going to be in much better shape.
Great. That's good to hear. And you mentioned a couple of things that people can do outside of, you know, to preventative measures. And then there's things that we probably learned that we can do inside of the hospital. So let's start on inside of the hospital. Is there, I noticed.
I love the hospital. This is the safest place to be right now. So if you have a problem, you need to come back here. We'll take care of you. And I'm totally serious. I mean, we've got a whole protocol in terms of making certain everything is clean when everyone comes into work. Your temperature is screened. Everyone has a masking policy regardless of what they're doing, maintaining social distance, et cetera. So I feel very safe when I'm in the
Is there any mandatory like COVID testing protocol for employees and or patients that come in for non-COVID related?
During the height of the pandemic, we were really, everyone who was coming in was getting a test to screen them. And sure enough, most everyone turned out to be positive. That is not the case anymore. And so in terms of who we're screening, who are asymptomatic, we have some high-risk populations that we look at. If someone has been exposed to the virus recently, a known exposure, we would test them. If they are from a congregant living facility, I would test them. If they're going to go to the intensive care unit, we test those from the standpoint that if they really get sick, they're going to get more complications. Similarly, if they're going to go to the OR, and then from the standpoint of exposure to other folks. So an immunocompromised patient. So we have high-risk populations that we are screening. I can tell you that with the asymptomatic screening right now, we're just not seeing positives because the percent is so low in the community. That said, I think we really do need to keep monitoring this. I'm not sure when you're going to show this video ultimately, but today is actually the day after the CDC walked back their recommendations, which the day before were we should not be testing anyone who's asymptomatic. And yesterday they walked that back a little bit due to the hullabaloo it generated in the medical community with that recommendation. So
where do they stand now? Like, that's a good point. I saw they walked it back. I mean, I saw the original, people shouldn't be tested. So they actually walked it back to the point of what?
If you're exposed, if there's a known exposure that you should be looked at. So then that gets to, you know, what we can be doing, and it comes up with the whole thing on masks. And I've thought about this very carefully because masks, unfortunately, have become a political issue. And so, so for disclaimer, I am an independent. Okay. So I take a look at this. Yeah. And so at one end of the spectrum, there are people who have, think there's a God-given, that's their position. Okay. And on the other end of the spectrum, there are people who think you need to be wearing a mask at all times, including if you are taking a solitary walk on a golf course, you need to have your mask on. Okay. These are equally silly positions in my estimation. And, you know, at some point there needs to be some science, which is where I land as an independent. And there's no doubt that masks have made a big, big difference. And, you know, particularly when you are indoors and you're around other folks, that's when you really need to have them, and they're very effective. Remember that when you're wearing a mask, actually, although you're affording some degree of self-protection, actually you're really protecting others from you. So that's sort of the story with the standard masks.
Hey, Jack, quick question on the masks, actually. You know, masks have become not only politicized, but they've become like fashion statements. But on top of that, you can buy masks anywhere. You have disposable masks. You have, you know, probably designer masks. You have N95 masks. You have, and then there's a number that's attached to some of them. Do you have a recommendation, or not even a recommendation, but how should people be looking at if they're going to purchase a mask, reusable versus non-reusable? Does it even matter? Is it the point just to have the mask and you're doing obviously something good to help others?
Yeah, no, doing something is better than doing nothing. So there's the first statement. And your standard cloth mask that you can reuse and wash, you know, those are not bad. And I think that's great if you're out in the community. And that's frankly what I usually end up doing. I have a nice cloth mask with some ducks on it that I tell people I got this from L.L. Bean, and they just sort of chuckle. But actually I got it from some good person out in the community, sewed this together, talking to community support. There's a lot of good sewers in the community that donate a lot of cloth masks. So, yeah, good people out there. So, but in the hospital, several types of masks. You have the N95 respirators, and those protect you as well as others from you. And that's the highest protection one can have.
Is that something sorry to cut you off. The N95, is that something that if the community, let's say they have one from a previous doctor visit or whatever, my wife has one from pregnancy. Yeah. Is that something that she should be wearing, or is it actually inhibiting breathing at that point?
Well, you can use them. I mean, the trick with N95s is you really need to test to make certain that they have a good fit. So there's that piece of it. You know, I think if you're out in the community, frankly, if you have a standard surgical mask, which you can buy, those actually work pretty well. And there's an interesting study that they did at Duke University where they actually looked at aerosol and particle spread, and they compared all these different types of masks. I was actually very impressed with the utility that I saw with just a plain surgical mask. Actually did a really very good job. And so, and it's interesting to take a look again how recommendations continue to evolve from the CDC, but there is a set of experts out there who will tell you that if you have on a surgical mask, if a patient you're encountering has a surgical mask on, you're probably as well protected as you would be if you had an N95 on. I think
another question on the mask, is that like a be all end all in terms of you're not going to contract the virus if your two people are wearing a mask, one person, let's say, has the virus, the other person doesn't? What if they're around each other for 5 minutes or a half an hour, not within maybe a few feet? Is it eliminating?
You never say never, that I've learned. And the recommendations continue to evolve. But you know, if you are around someone who has a virus for a fairly short period of time and you're not particularly close, if they have a mask on, you're probably going to do okay, which is not a guarantee by any means, but you're probably going to do okay.
Gotcha. No, thanks for that. That's very helpful information. I think the listeners will take a lot from that.
I can tell you over the past months, I wear a standard surgical mask. I have not worn N95s. I've been in units where they were caring for patients with COVID, not providing direct patient care myself. I've rubbed elbows with a number of employees who ended up having COVID, so I know I've been exposed to it. And, you know, knock on wood, I remain on this good earth and doing just fine. So, I'm a believer in the surgical mask.
No, that's great to hear. And then other things inside the medical center, in terms of one thing we saw during the peak was the ICU to ventilator ratio was like 1-to-1. Right now, what we see kind of in the state is it's, you know, 1-to, you know, it's 1-to-2. There could be ICU.
I don't think we have any patients on ventilators in the house today who have COVID. So that's a good thing. You know, what's interesting as we've watched this epidemic emerge is that the patients that, and I don't want to underplay the illness because it's still very, very serious, but what we're seeing right now, the degree of illness that we're seeing in patients presenting now is not what we're seeing back in April. And there's a whole bunch of speculation as to why that could be. And I'm actually not going to skate out onto that thin ice, but other than to observe that the patients have not been as ill for whatever reason.
Interesting.
Whether the virus is mutated, whether the more vulnerable folks who are going to get this actually had it, and and now they've had it and they're immune. I don't know, but it's not quite what we're seeing before.
Interesting. That's good to hear. Another question would be is in terms of therapeutics, things that we've learned from the onset to now. You've mentioned remdesivir and other types of things that the medical center is doing to monitor patients at home that may be symptomatic or be exposed to others. What types of things have we learned or is being used in the medical center or outside of it that we didn't know then that probably is a reason why in other areas of the country they're having maybe an uptick in cases, but not as many people are going to the hospital?
Yeah, so we've been involved with clinical trials throughout this, and one that we were involved with early was this whole issue on hydroxychloroquine and whether you're combining it with azithromycin or not. And what we were observing was that it does not appear that it was being helpful. And at this point, that's what the randomized trials are suggesting. So that's something that we have stopped doing for some time at this point.
Was it not helpful, but was it did it have a negative impact, or was it pretty much just not?
The national studies would suggest that particularly when you combine it with azithromycin, there was a negative impact on patients. And in terms of our experience here, I don't think it was large enough to really state that there was a statistically significant difference, although I think the literature would suggest that patients did not do as well if they were on that particular medicine. The other trial that we were involved with is convalescent plasma. We've been hearing about that lately as well. And so the party line of Atlantic Health System is that we really need to get more data regarding convalescent plasma. And that to do that, this really needs to be done through randomized clinical trials. Intuitively, it makes sense that if you were to treat people earlier on, that there might be some benefit. Unfortunately, the initial trials we were involved with were patients who were later in their disease course and were ill enough that they were, for instance, already on mechanical ventilators. And our data here really did not treating those patients. And there are some side effects with convalescent plasma. So yeah, I think we really need to use it. We need to put it in the context of a clinical trial and find out if it really helps. But from those, let's turn to some things that actually have been shown to have some benefit. And remdesivir is an antiviral, and that's been shown to lessen the course of illness. Patients, and there's a suggestion it may help mortality, but more a shortness of illness. And we participated in that.
Dexamethasone. Do you mind going back to the convalescent plasma? I think that's kind of sure. for the public and for the listeners. That's something that's kind of on the newer. People are starting to hear more about that in the last sure. couple days or weeks. So what exactly is that? Is it sure. being used? And how does it attack? How does it help mitigate the virus or eradicate? Okay,
it's a new topic, but it's an old treatment. And this was actually before we had antibiotics, and there was a time many years ago we didn't have antibiotics. What they would do is they would take patients who had recovered from an infectious disease, and you'd take their plasma, which would contain all the kinds of things you need to fight infections, largely antibodies, and you take that from the person who recovered and give it to someone who now had that infectious disease that would help them. And yeah, there were some studies that suggested that was helpful. And that's really the thinking that was being utilized in this case. So that's the story on convalescent plasma.
So a lot of people, I think that makes more sense, because I think a lot of people that we may know, friends, family, and acquaintances that have had the virus, they signed up to donate plasma. They signed up to donate their antibodies. That's what right. you're talking about. That's the convalescent yes. plasma. That and if that ends up being, like you said, it's kind of still being. It sounds like it's still being studied clinically, right. trials and things like that. But that could be a game changer.
Well, it's appealing from the standpoint that it makes. So there is a scientific basis here, and it sort of runs in parallel with this American sense of wanting to help your neighbor out. So if you've had this, do you have something you could give them that could help them? if it's your antibodies, you really don't know whether it could potentially help or not. There's such an entity called transfusion-associated acute lung injury. So that doesn't sound like a good thing. And you don't want to have that. You get that from being transfused. So we really need to do randomized clinical trials to see, does this really help this population or not? Intuitively to me, it makes sense that if it were to help, then we need to do trials in patients that are earlier in their illness rather than waiting too late, which is the analogy there is the horse has left the barn at that point. So getting back to the things that work, remdesivir is something that's been demonstrated to have success. So we have some studies from the UK looking at dexamethasone and a 5 or 10 day course, depending on whether you're in the hospital or not, has been demonstrated to be very effective at controlling the immune response that people have to the COVID-19. And some of this is not even so much the virus itself, but the immune response to it that can cause a lot of injury to the patient. So dexamethasone seems to control that. The other medicine trials have demonstrated a lot of a benefit from is something called Actemra or tocilizumab. And that is something called an interleukin 6 inhibitor. And basically suffice it to say, again, that works on the immune response. At this point, Atlantic is involved in a couple other clinical trials. If we start to see another surge of patients, we have a couple other antivirals. If we think back to what we did early on with HIV, we found that it was really a cocktail of antivirals that were able to turn the tide there. And so the question is, if one antiviral is good, like remdesivir, two would be better. Maybe three would be best of all. And so we're looking to see what makes sense there. So right now we've got a trial going with something called MMDP, which is great because to be eligible for that trial, you can still receive remdesivir and or dexamethasone, which are things that have been proven to be helpful. So if you're entering a clinical trial, you want to make certain that you're not shutting the doors to forms of therapy that have been proven to be effective. So that's a trial that makes a lot of sense to me. So we're, you know, continuing. And I'll anticipate your next question. We're not involved in a vaccine trial at this point.
How'd you know?
We're all praying for an effective vaccine that will come along here, because I think that's a big part of the answer. And since we're talking vaccines, I'm going to put in a plug, because one of the things we don't want to see is we don't want to see a twin pandemic. And by twin pandemic, I'm talking about influenza, which usually makes its way around these parts over the late fall and winter. And so I would suggest anyone who's listening or viewing this is that when the vaccine is available, this is a good thing to get to protect yourself from influenza, which can be a real problem. And you certainly don't want to have COVID-19 and influenza at the same time.
That's a good point, Jack. And I actually had a question on that. It raised a good point. In terms of what we can do at home, what we're doing with social distancing, what we're doing with masks, and now we're going into the flu season here in a month or so, do you foresee a potential decrease in flu this year as a result of all the things we're doing, washing our hands, wearing masks? I mean, we could have a double decrease and really come out unscathed. I mean, again, being optimistic, but that's potential, no?
Yeah, I lost you again here. Let me bring you back.
No problem, I'm still here.
Okay, there we go. So yeah, in terms of all those measures, and I already told you I'm an optimist, so I would like to think that if everyone has really gotten savvy on masks and washing their hands and keeping their distance, and frankly, and that's a new paradigm. I mean, the American work ethic is that you go to work, even if you're sick. I mean, that's the way I was raised. And that is not helpful in this day and age. So really, we really need to rethink this through. And that's an interesting discussion I've had with a number of colleagues. So, and I told you, I'm an optimist. So I would like to think, as you're suggesting, that if we're doing all those good public health measures and people are getting their influenza vaccine, we may see, you know, knock on wood, less influenza than we might ordinarily see. So
interesting.
Yeah. So I'm keeping my fingers crossed on that one. And
hope it comes true.
We all need a crystal ball these days, I suppose.
We do. I think we all understand that there's so much unknown about this virus, but it does sound like, from what you just detailed out very eloquently about the types of different trials that are being done, the types of different therapeutics, that some of them that are already working or shortening the life of the virus, and all these different things. And it sounds like everyone's working around the clock, not just here in New Jersey, but in this country and globally. So it sounds like together we'll be much better place as every day passes. So if you combine that with where we're at now, from an optimistic standpoint, sounds like we're beating this thing down pretty good. I had one. I'm going to let you go. I have one other question. Did you see a pent-up demand after the hospital kind of opened back up for elective surgeries and, you know, routine appointments? Like you mentioned in the beginning, people were afraid to come to the hospital. I was afraid to leave my house. So, right. You know, people were avoiding things that they probably shouldn't have even been avoiding. And then other things, maybe minor, they were just skipping those. So what happened when things opened back up? Was it free for all?
Well, we had to turn the spigot on carefully and in a controlled circumstance. And I think we've done a pretty good job of that. We're at the point now where actually, in terms of our surgical volume, we're running over 110% of what we would customarily see for this time of year. So we're very busy from a surgical standpoint, and predominantly elective surgery. So there's definitely been a pent-up demand that we're catching up with, a pent-up demand for screening. your screening colonoscopy, your mammogram, et cetera. So those types of things were starting to catch up. The emergency room is starting to get busier, but it's not back to where it was. And particularly with the pediatric population, kids are not out at school and doing their things. They're sort of at home, so they're having less problems that are causing them to present to accident rooms, so less of that. And on the medical side in the hospital, we are below our usual in terms of medical admissions to the hospital. So we're back and open for business, and there definitely has been some pent-up demand. And I would share with you that I've had some people anecdotally mention they've had patients come in for their screening procedures, and they found some disease states, cancer in particular, that were more advanced than, you know, had we had the screening exam done, you know, 4 months ago when it may have initially been scheduled, which is, you know, unfortunate, which is, you know, again, for people listening or viewing, you know, make certain that you're taking care of your basic health needs in terms of screening, those types of things.
So I was going to ask you, just while we wrap it up, if there's anything that you can leave us with in terms of advice, either from a COVID-19 perspective or overall health matters, what would you like to say to listeners or people that are watching? What should we be doing?
I think we need to respect the science here. I mean, there's a lot of chatter out there. I think we need to listen to the experts and heed their wise counsel. I mean, it's a very interesting time. From my own personal perspective, I can tell you that I cut my teeth as a physician during the early days of HIV. And not that I'm looking to pack it in anytime soon, but it's closer than it used to be. And it's just interesting as I look at a career beginning with HIV and sort of coming to a close with this, there's some interesting parallels in terms of the fear that everyone would have and sort of their response to things. And the fact that heroes emerged during these times in terms of their willingness to continue to care for patients, and that science works hard to find out what, frankly, we need to do to help patients out. So to me, it's really a very inspiring time in terms of meeting the need.
And Dr. Audette, what can we do as a community to help support you and or other medical facilities in our communities here in New Jersey?
I think it's just a matter of just following the advice that's out there in terms of the public health measures to make certain we're cautious with our masks and keeping our distance and, you know, keeping things clean. Don't be what our governor would term a knucklehead.
There
you go. don't be knuckle. A knucklehead. Now you've heard the same advice from Jack. Don't be a knucklehead.
There you go. Murphy might have coined it, but
yeah. I think he's got some good stuff there. And again, I'm an independent. But, yeah.
I like it. Well, thank you very much for your time today. I really appreciate it. Dr. Audette, Chief Medical Officer there at Overlook Medical Center. And I really appreciate your time today. Please give the staff and everyone our best. We're really proud of our community medical centers who stepped up in the time of need and really helped everyone. And I think that shows the strength of New Jersey and our community here and the Overlook area and Summit and beyond. So thank you. And please give everyone else our thanks. And we look forward to hopefully catching up soon in a nice down period about other things that are going on.
Well, you know, I thank the community for supporting us through this time and, frankly, for trusting us with your care. So thank you. It's our privilege to be here.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Audette. We appreciate it, and we'll talk to you soon.
All right. Where the talk is real. Garden State Debate. No joke, no frills. Garden State Debate. It's the talk of the town. Garden State Debate. For people all around, yeah. Garden State Debate. Garden State Debate. Garden State Debate.